You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look at efforts to restore habitat for the migrating monarch butterfly population from Wisconsin down to Mexico.
I feel a change in the weather. I feel a change in me. The days are getting shorter and the birds begin to leave.
First, Josh Ritter loves words, and the storytelling songs he writes are chock full of fast-flying words. His songwriting draws on the unspooling stories of the old-school folk music tradition, even though his music is squarely in the folk rock genre. But as big as Ritter's name gets, he still gets compared to one of folk music's greatest heroes, Bob Dylan.
Ritter's new album is all about looking ahead, telling stories, and being playful. Ritter calls the style messianic, oracular honky-tonk. It's called Sermon on the Rocks. He'll be playing it along with old favorites tonight in Milwaukee at the Pabst Theater at 8 o'clock.
We caught up with Josh Ritter a few days ago on the road. Josh, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, you've said, I read somewhere, that you say your new album is that feeling when a dog wakes up in the morning and it shakes itself off, and I guess a feeling of a fresh day. Can you flesh that out a little bit, what this album feels like to you?
Well, On occasion, you know, there's something grabs a hold of you, and it feels like rather than riding the horse, you're tied to the horse, you know, and you feel like songs take on new life. You find some new kind of wormhole to travel down, and everything feels like fresh and different. It's sort of like how food tastes better like late at night. It's something that changes, and you can't always predict when it's going to come. But for this record, it was in full effect.
Do you have any idea what changed? I mean, in reading about this album, it's interesting because people said, you know, Josh Ritter is sort of shaking off the introspective album, moving on to something new, a new sound. People are recognizing that it's new, but did you have any control over it? Do you know what changed?
Well, you know, I gave myself the free pass to do a record that was biographical, autobiographical, and you know, it was after my divorce and in the time leading up to my whole new life with my wonderful family, and that record was very introspective, and I typically feel that autobiographical records aren't that interesting, you know, and especially done one after the other. It stops being interesting to me. So after that record, I had a real desire to write outwardly, and I had the idea of a record that just felt like it was exploding outwards, and so that's what I was able to sort of conceive of and write. There's a lot of characters on the record that aren't me, and that feels good.
Right. Well, speaking of characters, there's one in the song Henrietta, Indiana. This is a song about a factory closing, and in the song, there's a character that you say feels really fully fleshed out. How did that person's voice and their story get into your head?
Well, the Henrietta, Indiana came to me as a town. Just the title of it just came into my head, Henrietta. It just rolled off the tongue, and I had an idea immediately of what that town was like, and this girl living in this town, you know, and her father and brother had, you know, their path towards a better life or a life that's sustainable just gets shut off, and they each deal with it in their own way, and she's watching them make the choices that they make, and the choices that they make, you know, they affect in the end the big choice she has to make, whether to follow them, you know, or whether to stay and try and live in Henrietta, Indiana. And I just that song just kind of came out of my head, just fully formed. The character was there, and I was really lucky. I was sitting down at the right time.
Henrietta, Indiana, milk town. Locked the factory down and shut it up tight. My daddy and my brother and 1,600 others lost everything they had in the night. Daddy got a taste for the hard stuff. Henrietta, Indiana was dry. We'd ride out to Putney, he'd tell me he loved me. The drive home was always so quiet. He had a devil in his eye. Like a thorn in the paw, disregard for the law, disappointment to the Lord on high.
Is this a topic that you think about? I mean, we hear a lot about income inequality right now. You're in the folk genre. It's folk rock for you, but that's been a preoccupation of folk music for a long time. The plight of the working class, is that part of this?
I think that's true. I mean, it's impossible not to look around and not see the kind of ravages that are being, you know, waged on people that have no defenses or have no real resources to fight them. You know, well, you know, it's tough. You know, payday loans and exorbitant mortgages and opiate addictions and just a real difficult time. And like you say, folk music has always been folk music by dint of the fact that it like taps into the wider culture in a deep way. You know, I think that's what makes it folk music.
Now you've got this character, and it sounds like you feel kind of close to her, and she kind of just came to you in this song. Do you think you're going to write any more about her down the road?
I don't know. Like it's interesting to wonder if like that character will come around. You know, that I would certainly be grateful.
Next album.
Yeah, we'll see.
Well, so another song on this new album is called Sermon on the Rocks. The critics are really loving. It's called Getting Ready to Get Down. And this is a trip to listen to. I mean, the words just come a mile a minute in the song. Singing it, I don't know, it feels like it might be like being in the eye of a hurricane. What does it feel like to you to perform that one?
That one grabbed a hold of me, and it was one of the last ones I wrote for the record. And I didn't have a guitar in my hand when I was working on it. I was just scribbling away furiously. I had a rhythm in there, and I wrote and wrote and wrote. And when it was done, and I tried to play it, there was no space for breath. So I thought, how will I ever perform this? Because there's no spot for me to breathe, and there's a lot of words and a lot of stuff to remember. But over time, I've managed to sneak in a few Olympic sized breaths, so I can get the whole song out. You know, it's a really exhilarating song to play. You know, it's got my band plays so well, and they really make it fun.
Mama got a look at you and got a little worried. Papa got a look at you and got a little worried. The pastor got a look and said, y'all better hurry. Send her off to a little Bible college in Missouri. And now you come back saying you know a little bit about every little thing they ever hoped you'd never figure out. Eve ate the apple because the apple was sweet. Kind of God would ever keep a girl from getting what she needs. And I'm getting ready to get down. Getting ready to get down.
And this isn't the first song of yours that has this sort of torrent of words thing going on in it. And before we started recording, you told me you've been for a big, long run today. Is that part of why you run, so that you have the lungs to breathe in these songs with all these words?
I guess that might be like a good side effect. I run because if I don't, I go crazy. You know, I need something to like calm me down and make me sore throughout the day. And running is also, it's a great way to see a town. You know, it's good to get out. The bus is can be like in the morning, a kind of a dark place, and you got to get out into the sunlight and get your day jump started. And for me, running is that beautiful solitary activity. I can listen to music or I can listen to a book. It's great.
And as we said, your new album, it's called Sermon on the Rocks. You use the phrase, I think you said, it calms you down when you go running. And it makes me wonder, you know, with these other changes that you described, you have a partner, you have a daughter now, and then this album has all this religious imagery on it. I mean, it's kind of turned upside down on its head, but there are these religious terms and language pieces in this album. Is that something you're thinking about at all, the big picture, religion, the meaning of life?
Well, it's always been something that's been on my mind, and I always seem to have written about, you know, like subjects that are spiritual in nature, and specifically like use a lot of Christian imagery, and I don't know why Exactly. You know, I don't consider myself to be a believer. I believe in many other things, you know, like my family and music and whiskey and all sorts of other stuff. But I never thought of myself as a true believer. But for some reason, those words just keep coming out. You know, they're in there deep from when I was brought up, you know, quite religious. And I still find that, you know, as a way to write a song, there's something about the symbolism in each of these stories that can act, that can tell a lot within a very small amount of space. So you tell the story of, like, you mentioned Cain and Abel, and the story is in there, and you don't have to go into details. It's just something that comes out of me, but it's also very convenient as a songwriter.
It's interesting. So you were raised very religious, and the language stuck around, but the faith didn't. What happened?
Yes. I just, you know, I found that there were other things that I believed in that weren't compatible. I didn't find that religion made me happy, you know? And I thought, like, well, if religion isn't making me happy, then what's it for? So, and I think a lot of the stuff on this record on Sermon on the Rocks is trying to square away some of the statements in the Bible that I find don't make sense to me living here on the ground as an earthly person. The short answer is this: I found other things that I believe in more and that mean a lot more to me.
Josh, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I really, really appreciate it.
Josh Ritter was named one of the 100 greatest living songwriters by Pace magazine. He's playing Milwaukee tonight at the Pabst Theater at 8 o'clock. His new album is called Sermon on the Rocks.
Coming up, there's been a dramatic decrease in the monarch butterfly population migrating through the United States up into Wisconsin. We'll hear about efforts to bring back their habitat and restore their numbers. First, look at some of the latest news.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there are a lot of reasons why it can be hard to say no when you're asked to do something. But our guest says that there are important reasons to learn how, and that instead of damaging relationships, it can actually make them stronger. We'll find out why.
First, there's been a lot of concern about monarch butterflies in recent years, especially because of their long migration route and their wintering habitat in Mexico being vulnerable. Sadly, those fears are well-placed. They have experienced a decline of 90% in the last 20 years, and like other species in crisis, they face challenges from climate change, habitat loss, and more.
Joining us now to talk about monarch butterflies is Colin O'Mara. He's the president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation. Colin, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, we're hearing these numbers about the decline of the monarch butterflies over the years, and it sounds like a big part of the story is habitat decline. What have we seen over the last couple of decades?
Yeah, so over the past, say, 15, 20 years, we've seen a population of monarchs making the annual migration drop from over a billion monarchs to 50 or 60 million in the last couple of years. And these are monarchs that over several generations in the same year, but over several generations go all the way from overwintering habitat in Mexico up to Canada through, you know, right through beautiful Wisconsin on their way. And the populations have just plummeted. And there's a variety of reasons. But one of the big ones that we estimate that we've lost 165 million acres of milkweed habitat across this central flyway corridor.
What are we losing that habitat to?
So it's a range of things, but the biggest one is just development, and that might be conversion of grasslands and you know, wetlands and other natural areas for agriculture. It might be for housing developments, but we've become very good at it as a society at eradicating any kind of plant that we don't absolutely want and exactly where we want it. And so, you know, 30 years ago, if you were traveling in Wisconsin looking at farm fields, you'd see, you know, patches on the edges of, you know, different kind of native plants or, you know, kind of uncultivated areas. You don't see a lot of that now. And folks are, you know, farming right to the edge. You know, median strips in highways are, you know, often perfectly manicured with grass. And so a lot of these places that provided important milkweed habitat for species like monarchs have just been basically eradicated through a combination of monoculture crops or just kind of landscaping in a way that doesn't value the native species as much as before.
And big picture, it sounds like you're making the case for a corridor, a migration corridor, north-south for the monarchs. What would that look like?
All of us were in third or fourth grade, right? We had that first experience with the monarch, and we learned about the stages of metamorphosis. We learned about the chrysalis and becoming a butterfly. The one thing that I think maybe we didn't all take away was the importance of kind of habitat corridors and making sure that at every step of their journey from Mexico and through the Great Lakes and then into Canada, that there's sufficient kind of milkweed habitat for these species to lay eggs on, to eat, and then, you know, kind of move on. And so what we're trying to do is basically build out this habitat corridor to address the deficiency that I mentioned before. And if you look kind of like through the central flyways, starting way down south in, you know, Laredo, Texas, and San Antonio, up through your neck of the woods, that central corridor, it's about 1,500 miles. If we can plant a significant amount of habitat there, we should be able to at least quadruple, if not improve the monarch populations even more in the next couple of years.
Let's talk about what that would take. I want to get into individuals, say property owners and farmers in a minute. But it sounds like this is a big project. It would take more than that. What would national and state governments need to do to participate in this corridor?
Yeah, I talk about it often is we have to kind of crowdsource the solution, right? You're going to have a whole bunch of actions at pretty much every level. And at the national level, we formed a partnership with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service under the leadership of Dan Ash to focus their resources on this crisis, and Tom Melius, who runs the region for Wisconsin and Minnesota, has been a great champion as well. And so what they're working with us on is actually convening state-level conversations among the state agencies, among, you know, kind of different nonprofit partners, conservation groups, to talk about what the state plan should look like and kind of what are the areas that make the most sense. The next piece is working with the mayors, and there's been great leadership across the region. 153 mayors have already signed the National Wildlife Federation's pledge to help conserve the monarch, and they're all taking actions to do that. And I think we're seeing everything from planting of median strips and parks to improving policies that might make it hard for folks to have, you know, milkweed in their backyard. Some places, some municipal building codes actually don't allow you to have milkweed over a certain height in your yard because it's considered an eyesore. And so we're fixing a lot of things like that. And so right in Wisconsin, we've seen Mayor Vanderstein in Sheboygan and the Fitchburg mayor and the Hales Corner village president already step up. We're really hoping to work with the mayor of Madison and others in the region as well. But so that's the city piece. And then getting down to the individuals, we're encouraging individuals to basically sign up to be a butterfly hero. And if they go to our website, the NWF.org, that's NWF.org. If they go to the website, they send us a quick picture of them flashing the universal sign for a butterfly, which is the kind of hands folded across your chest. And we'll actually send folks a packet of milkweed. We'll send out kind of a how-to kit, a little Ranger Rick nature guide. We public Ranger Rick magazine, so we want the kids to have a good kind of outdoor guide for them when they're doing different naturalist activities. And so there's really things, again, it's federal, it's state, it's local, and it's individual. And to do this well, it's going to take all those entities working together, all the way from Texas, all the way through Wisconsin.
We're talking to Colin O'Meara from the National Wildlife Federation about efforts to turn the tide on declining numbers of monarch butterflies. Colin, let's talk about the impact. What do we lose when we lose monarch butterflies and the numbers you're talking about?
So the monarch is an iconic species, right? I mean, I think all of us had that kind of that childhood experience, and all of us can remember, you know, times when there were probably more at different parts of the year. But they also provide an incredible ecological value, and that's they're pollinators. And one out of every three bites of food that we all eat is basically courtesy of a pollinator, whether that's a native bee or a butterfly or, you know, some birds. And so when you start losing these pollinators at scale, it's pretty disruptive to the entire way we source food in this country. And now, as alarmed as I am about the monarch recovery, you know, we're also doing a lot of work with, you know, native bees of different kinds that are in peril in many parts of the country. And so, you know, if you want a healthy food supply, if you want to, you know, continue to eat that, you know, maybe that chocolate from down south, or, you know, that great fruit, piece of fruit, you know, that's because of pollinators. And so we need these species to thrive. And so they're not just pretty, they're pretty helpful as well.
As you mentioned, we count monarch butterflies, migrating monarch butterflies, in the tens of millions, which sounds like a lot, but compared to that billion number, not so much. Should monarchs be considered an endangered species?
So there's been a petition that's gone before the Fish and Wildlife Service to try to have them listed. And what we've been saying is that because monarchs cover almost the entire country, about more than half of them are in the central flyway, that there might be better solutions than just strictly listing it under the Endangered Species Act. So, you know, we've been encouraging these, you know, kind of voluntary efforts and efforts of mayors and states and governors to be given a chance to work for a little bit. But then if they fail, I mean, I think then we have to have a serious conversation. But typically, the Endangered Species Act is the last resort. And so I think there's some things we need to try to do first. Last year in Mexico, we actually had a pretty good habitat, pretty good overwintering climate, you know, kind of weather. And so the numbers were a little better last year. So there's some upticks. And then we're also seeing, you know, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of acres of milkweed being being planted right now. So I'm confident that's going to work. I don't think listing will be necessary, but you know, as a last resort, you know, I think it's important enough to keep these species thriving. So, you know, my daughter, who's 4, and hopefully her kids, you know, many years down the road, can have the same experiences we had growing up.
Colin, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Colin O'Mara, President and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation. He joined us to talk about different approaches to protecting monarch butterflies and other vulnerable species.
Coming up, do you have a hard time saying no even when you really should not be saying yes? We'll talk about why learning to say no can be one of the most important skills to develop. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Right now it's time for a check of the latest news. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
On the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're heading into the summer months, which we often think of as a time to relax, maybe do some stuff we've meant to do but haven't gotten around to, maybe even take some time to get away.
We live in a multitasking culture, and if we're not doing two or three things at the same time, sometimes it seems like we're not doing enough. And we also tend to have busy schedules with jobs and family commitments and social lives. It's easy to feel like we're doing as much as we can, but what happens when someone asks us to do even more?
Well, according to our next guest, we're likely to say yes, no matter how busy or stressed we're already feeling. Elizabeth Bernstein writes the Bonds column for the Wall Street Journal. We talked with her about her inability to say no and what we can do about it. We started the interview by asking her just why it's so difficult for people to say no.
Well, you know, in a nutshell, we want to get along. We are pleasers, most of us, or at least we want people to like us. It's very important to be part of communities. So it's very hard then to feel like we're rejecting somebody when we say no to them.
And how does not saying no get us into trouble when it comes to our busy work and personal lives?
Well, we're all, as you say, so busy. We're almost overwhelmed. I mean, the kids, 2 jobs, you know, just everything, the pace of modern life with technology. And so we have requests coming at us from all areas, from our families, from our friends, from bosses, coworkers, and charities. It goes on and on. And so if we don't learn to say no, we'll get nothing done. We really have to protect what's important to us and what we most want to get done. To protect our priorities, we really have to learn to manage them. And doing that is saying no to the ones that are not that important to us.
And I think that the ones who are not that important to us tend to feel bad when we say no. At least that's what it seems like we're worried about, that when we say no to somebody, we're going to hurt their feelings and we're going to damage a relationship no matter what level that relationship is at. Is that true? How damaging is saying no?
Well, it is exactly that. That's what we're worried about. You know, it's true, actually. Our brains react more strongly to negative information than they do to positive. So when someone hears a no, they do have a pretty strong reaction just in their brain. Neuroscience shows us that. But at the same time, there's something out there that researchers call the harshness bias. And what this is that we feel others will judge us more than they actually will. We're worried that the the amount of hurt that we're going to give or the amount of criticism we're going to get is worse than it will actually be. So yes, people will be hurt when we say no, probably, but it won't be as bad. They won't be as devastated as we think they will be.
Well, and that gap is probably where the trouble comes from, the difference between how bad they'll really feel and how bad we expect they'll feel if we say no to whatever the request is.
Exactly. So in that gap is where all the problems happen.
So how do we get around that then? So we know we've got this gap. We know we'll be better off if we learn to say no. How do we take those first steps and start to get more comfortable with it?
Well, it's interesting. I talk to sort of therapists and other experts, psychologists on this, and they say that the number one thing you want to do is plan ahead. So you want to have sort of a no in your back pocket. You want to have a ready-to-use answer for requests of any kind, really, that you don't think you can do. So you want to have it. It should be polite. When you deliver it, it should be gentle. You don't want to just shout out, no, I would never do that. You know, so you want to sort of say, I'm sorry, but I cannot do that. But it also should be definitive, exactly that. You know, I cannot do that. Those are the big ones. Also, another interesting, important thing to do would be to learn not to say yes on the spot. So maybe you get blindsided, you're at work, coworker asks you, hey, can you drive me home tomorrow, whatever it is, and you can't do it, you need to say, you know what, let me think about that, I'll get back to you. So you want to learn not to say yes just because you're put on the spot and you don't know what else to say.
And in terms of the research on this, there is actual research about people being biased against saying no. Isn't there? People will go to incredible lengths to say yes or to avoid saying no is more the point.
Exactly. People will go to incredible lengths to not have the uncomfortableness of saying no. So researchers do study this. And they also know that if we say a no one time, if we decline a request, we're more likely to say yes the next time, simply because of the guilt of saying no that first time. But researchers study saying no. And in one study that I liked, they asked people, they got a whole bunch of college students to go up to strangers with a library book. The college students had a library book. They asked these strangers to deface the library book by writing the word pickle in it in pen. And they had predicted the students, they'd asked the students, predict how many people do you think will do this? And the students said, oh, about 29% of people will do this. It turned out it was half the people said, oh, okay, I don't feel comfortable doing this, but I'll do it. They'd rather write pickle in a library book than say no and hurt the feelings of a stranger.
Is there a certain personality type that has more trouble with this than others?
There are. Anybody who is a pleaser, who, wants to please, there's people who are conflict adverse. They don't like to be in any kind of uncomfortable situation where there's an argument or a conflict. Those people, there are people who just habitually say yes to everything, sort of the so-called doormats who just, never ever step up and say no and protect themselves.
Is there any research on whether it's better in terms of the reaction we have in our brains when we hear no, whether it's better to have someone just say a flat out no or to have someone say yes, but then keep stringing the other person along, say an office mate who keeps wanting to clean out the office.
Just hypothetically.
And that office mate keeps canceling the cleanup date and week after week goes by and the office never gets cleaned out.
I don't know of any particular research on that, but I did ask psychologists that, and they say that it is better to be upfront. And so where you get yourself into a problem is stringing the other person along.
Uh-huh.
Because now you have to basically, if you're saying yes and you really mean no, you're lying. Or, you're just at the very best, you're putting off your decision to say no or the uncomfortableness of saying no. And so you're stringing it out, but you also are having to say it over and over. So it's better for both of you to say, look, I'm really sorry. I'm not going to be up for cleaning that office. I'm perfectly good with the mess as it is.
So the takeaway is that Rob is a liar.
Hey, whoa. We can get into this off air.
Okay.
Operation Cleansing Flame will be a reality at some point in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in our society, Elizabeth, we're often confronted with people who won't take no for an answer, whether it's a friend, a boss, somebody soliciting money on the phone, who their job in some ways is to break down that initial no, or a salesperson. How hard does that make it? How can we inure ourselves to that?
It makes it so much harder. So, yes, a lot of people, it is their job, and they are trained well to make sure that they do not take no for an answer. So moms are among that group, by the way, too. What you need to do is stand firm, and that makes it even harder. So you said no one time, and now you have to say it a bunch more, but you need to learn to do that. So again, the experts will say you stay polite and you say, no, I'm sorry, I can't do that. And no matter how many times that person says, but are you sure you don't really want to buy, you know, these bonds I'm selling, then you keep saying, no, I'm sorry, I don't want to do that. You just have to keep repeating the same thing over and over.
In our lives, though, there will be times when it'll be better off for everyone if we say yes. Assuming we take the time after that initial request, don't immediately say yes, how do we start doing that mental triage that, yeah, this is something I can prioritize and know that other thing isn't?
Well, so that's why, again, you don't want to give an answer right away. So you say, let me sit on that, let me sleep on that, and then you think about it. And you're right, there are times, many times really, especially with family or your boss, that you're better off saying yes, even if it's something you didn't want to do or squeezing it in. And so then you really have to think, like, you know, I'm not the only person here that has to be happy with this decision. Will the most amount of people be happier? Will it benefit my family? Will it benefit my job? You want to ask yourself these questions, like what's the upside of doing this? And you may find out that it's not that hard to see that it's something you should do.
That's Elizabeth Bernstein, columnist at the Wall Street Journal, talking about why it's so hard to tell people no and how we can change our thinking and habits.
We're revisiting an earlier interview with her, and we'll hear the second half of that conversation in just a moment. First, a look at some of the latest news from WPR. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We are revisiting an interview with Elizabeth Bernstein. She writes the bonds column at the Wall Street Journal. We talked with her about the habit of saying yes too fast and too often when people ask us to do stuff, and how we can develop the habit of saying no when it's really the best choice.
Elizabeth, we talked about some of the techniques we can use to learn to say no. One of them is repeating the same words over and over again, or giving yourself space to think about it and maybe building up to that no. What about tone of voice? Does that matter?
It does matter. Being a gentle, sort of calm tone of voice. What happens is, I think some of us feel that we just get pushed too far. We're spread thin to begin with. Then someone's coming at us with a request, and we try to say no, but we really waffle out of it. And, you know, by the time we really decide we need to say no, we're just shouting it out or, you know, snapping and saying, no, I can't. So you want to be gentle and polite, very polite, and just say, look, I wish I could, but I cannot. I am sorry. So, the tone does matter a lot.
And how about hedging? Like, well, not this time, but maybe next year, or maybe sometime, but not now.
Well, by doing that, they've got you. So maybe next year, they're coming right back at you next year. So probably charities love this because they just put you right on their list for next year. So, you know, no should be no unless you want them to come back next year. Maybe, you know, you just this year you're done with these requests, but next year you have time. But if you don't want them to come back, forget it. It's like telling a telemarketer, yeah, call me next week. No, you don't want to hear from them next week, so...
Do you have any stories about people who did harness the power of saying no and how it changed their lives?
I did. I have stories of people learned how they sort of taught themselves how to say no. One woman was, she said she's very petite and sort of had a gentle voice, but she was also a pretty big executive, and people would not really take no, especially she was always asked to sit on charity boards, and they wouldn't necessarily take no for an answer. She felt they didn't take her seriously when she tried to push back. She was spread thin. She was on too many boards. So she said she would stand on her office chair. She would get up on her office chair to make herself feel stronger and taller and bigger, and she would sort of growl no at them. So it did backfire once when her boss walked in, but other than that, I think it worked out okay for her. She even told me her tips on balancing on the swivel chair. She
wow.
said, you put one knee on the desk.
Don't try this at home. Well, Elizabeth, I know you know people and you have readers, and often when you write things like this, it touches a nerve with a lot of people. Is this one of those? Do you keep hearing from people who say, oh my God, this is my life?
Yeah, I do. People say, wow, like, that's me. You know, not everybody. Of course, there are people who have no trouble at all saying no. It's just their knee-jerk reaction to almost anything. But, you know, most people, a lot of people wrote me and said, you know, this is me. Thank you. I hate letting people down. Or, you know, and what's interesting, too, is there's not research that shows whether men and women are different, but the experts who study it say, anecdotally, they believe that women have a harder time saying no, and that's because women are they're conditioned to be the connectors in society and in their families. They're the ones that have to keep all the relationships going, and so they're really juggling so many more balls in the air, so it's hard to let people down. But men are conditioned to, you know, provide for their families, and so with that goal in mind, and it's very easy for them to say, well, no, this doesn't fit into that goal, so of course I wouldn't do that.
Let's go to the phones right now. We have Marcus with us from Green Bay. Hi, Marcus.
Hello. I recently volunteered to give an older gentleman a ride home from the food pantry with his groceries. One thing led to another, and I was bringing him for rides all over the place. And one day he called me. I was shoveling snow, and I carefully explained to him that I couldn't do it. He wouldn't take no for an answer, and this went on and on and on until finally I wouldn't answer the phone. There were messages. Tons of messages, and finally he sent over the police because he was supposedly concerned. They told me to block the phone, that they know this gentleman, and now I find out he's slandering my name up and down this strip of businesses where I live, blaming me for all his woes. So what, you know, I have a note in my wallet with three sentences explaining that I'm not responsible for him or his personal problems. Mm-hmm. What how should I feel about this? I do feel a bit of anger and yet sympathy.
Gotcha.
Person, so.
Marcus, I want to get Elizabeth in on this. Unfortunately, you know, a good deed done there, but taken advantage of, I guess, and an expectation that he'd keep doing things for a person.
Exactly. This person had an expectation. It's very hard. I can appreciate how you feel, because you probably feel guilty as well. Like, you know, you're somebody who needs help, and you know, but I can't step up all the time. But you're right. Your note in your wallet is correct. You're not responsible for someone else. You did a good deed. If you want to do a good deed again, that's great. Hopefully it will not escalate in the future with someone else. But also, my guess is someone that is that, I mean, I shouldn't say anything bad, but my guess is someone that latches on to you, a stranger, and will not let go, probably has some other problems too, thinking correctly. And so this is not even somebody who sort of has an ability to lead his life pretty well, I'm guessing. So you should all know this person doesn't probably think correctly. It's not my fault. It's not my responsibility to take care of it. And don't let that stop you, though, from trying to do more good deeds.
And we had a caller who couldn't stay on the line who asked, how can a business communicate a change of policy to customers who might not like the new change without losing the customer? So for businesses who, you know, that the old credo, the customer is always right, how do they handle that?
I think you would want to explain it certainly very carefully, why you're doing this, why you have to change whatever the thing is you're changing. But also, if people are upset, listen to them. Listen to them carefully and say, I'm upset. Don't just keep telling them, oh, well, this is good for you, if they feel that it's not. Say, I'm really sorry. I really hear you, but unfortunately, this is the change we had to make. I think sometimes when people feel heard, that's enough. You know, they don't need you to do what they want, as long as they do feel you at least heard them.
We also had a note from Reed in Clintonville who says, when I get a telemarketer on the phone, I engage that person in conversation and ask lots of questions about themselves, where they're from, because they don't want to talk about themselves. They want to make a sale. They get off the phone pretty quickly. So I guess divert and change the subject a little bit to say no.
Totally. Yeah, change all the rules on them. But the problem is, what if you get a chatty one? You'll be on there forever. But that's a good strategy. Might want to try it.
Did you meet anyone who is a super no-sayer and just really went to town with it and employed it all the time? I'm just curious about you know, whether in general people do say no or say yes too often. And if they really just, you know, the opposite of saying yes all the time, if they say no all the time, they're happier.
I think people who say no all the time, well, I don't know if they're happier. I haven't met somebody, as you said, but I've witnessed it. I've seen people who are very good at this. And I don't know if they're happier, but I do imagine that they have more time for their own priorities and their own things they want to do. So perhaps they really are happier. The only drawback would be, you know, are they making the connections they need to make and sustaining them? If they're making people mad, you know, then they're, you know, they may not be happier, but maybe they're saying no effectively and politely, and then going off and doing things that they like to do.
How are you at saying no, Elizabeth? We're glad you say yes when people ask you to come on Midwestern public radio programs. Keep doing that. But apart from important things like that, how are you on this whole yes-no thing?
I am not so good, depending on who it is. So if it's a family member, if it's my mom, if it's a good friend, like it's hard for me to say no then. But, you know, so I'm learning. That's one reason I needed to write the article.
Are there different cultures that are better at saying no? I wonder sometimes if it's a peculiar American thing that we really want to keep saying yes.
You know, I don't know about research about that, but I would guess that Americans are, you know, have a good day. They're known, you know, sort of around the world for being people who have sort of almost what reads to other cultures as almost like a fake politeness. And so, you know, maybe somewhere in there we say, you know, yes a lot. So I don't really know the answer, but my guess is Americans could use some lessons in saying no.
And I wonder about, you know, habits of highly effective people and success in the business world and that sort of thing. If there's a rivalry in schools of thought between, yeah, say yes, get involved, get things done, you'll impress people, versus no, don't take on too much, focus on what you're doing and do it well.
I think it is. It's a balance that you have to strike. So, because if you're saying yes across the board, I mean, this is also the work-family balance. If you're saying, you know, yes to everything, you're not going to be able to prioritize and move forward on the things that are important. So you can't just say yes to everything across your company because your own boss is going to be upset. You know, why aren't you doing, you know, what my department needs you to do? So it's probably, you're right, it's probably a balance that you really have to work at continuously.
And you talked about women, but if you look at, you know, for instance, Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In campaign, which involves saying yes an awful lot and then some, maybe to get things done, it's just the wrong way to go, leaning in. I don't know. Have you thought about leaning in and saying no?
Well, I know some of the criticism for leaning in, which, you know, so many people, you know, think is so interesting and good, but I have heard some of the criticism is that, you know, it's nice if you have a big support network. So you can say yes to everything if you've got a staff to help you, nannies and housekeepers and all of these things. But if it's just you, you know, raising your kids, going to work, keeping your family going, and all the other things, you know, wanting to give some money to charity, say, but you can't give it all away. So you do, no matter what, even if you do lean in, you still need to prioritize.
That was Elizabeth Bernstein. She writes the Bonds column at the Wall Street Journal. And we talked to her about how to say yes to saying no.
Or is it how to say no to saying yes? Either way, we're glad you said yes to tuning in today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.